unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good evening again, everybody. So I couldn't help thinking as we chanted that, like, you know, what does that vow really mean? You know, to really take in everything as the Tathagata's words, to really pay attention that deeply, little by little, you know. Before the talk, just a Sangha announcement. And we may hear a little more from Kate or maybe Edie at the end about this. But just so you know, that our member, Diane Latona, is in the hospital in Seattle, UW Medical. She's been living with ovarian cancer for a number of years, 4 or 5, I think, which is in itself kind of a miracle, apparently. But anyway, the current resurgence is powerful, not responding well to medication, and it's impacting her, starting to impact her other systems. So we're hopeful she'll be back home with her husband, Talis, who's also a member in Ferndale, in a couple days, but it's hard to know. Kate has the address for sending cards to her room. If you want to send her a card, she'd love that. And there's not a whole lot we can do if she gets back home because of social distancing and all that, but we'll hear more about how we can help. But it's mostly just presence, I think, and holding them in our hearts. They're a Sangha romance. Do you know that? They met in Red Cedar Zen and are one of the closer married couples that I've ever encountered. So, sorry about the bad news, but I thought you'd want to know. So yeah, our joking around about funerals at the beginning, a little more zing to it, actually. Yeah, but it's still good to be able to joke around. Life and death, huh? So the 39th case of the Mumon Khan, it's only 48 of them. I'm getting so close. You'll be ready. Glad when we're done, we'll see. Anyway, this is a story within a story, as so many of them are. And it really features some sort of classic Zen musing about words and going beyond words. And it includes a big interruption. And it actually does turn out to be pretty relevant because it's kind of like the whole world got interrupted, right? So I thought we can do a little contemplation around interruption and obstacles and something stopping us, right? So many things stop us cold. And how do we practice with that? How do we work with that? How do we live with that? So here's the koan. Case 39, the title is Yunmen's You Have Misspoken. A monk spoke to Yunmen and said, "The radiance serenely illuminates the whole universe." But before he had finished his sentence, Yunmen interrupted him and asked, "Aren't those the words of Changcho?" And the monk said, "Yes, they are." And Yunmen told the monk, "You have misspoken." Later, the master Xu Xin took up this matter and asked the assembly, "Tell me, where did the monk misspeak?" So we've met Yunmen several times. I especially love the case which has him reflectively asking the monks, "Why do you put on the 7-panel robe at the sound of the bell?" It's always been such a beautiful slogan. Why do we practice? And he's in several cases. So here's the story again. A monk said to Yunmen, this radiance serenely illumines the whole universe. Before he had finished speaking, Yunmen interrupted him and asked, "Aren't those the words of Changzhou?" The monk said, "Yes, they are." And Yunmen said, "You have misspoken." And later, the master Su Xin took up this matter and asked the assembly, "Tell me, where did the monk misspeak?" So the unnamed monk is quoting from a well-known poem, which is, had been written like only 50 years or so before this story happened in the Tang Dynasty in China in the 7th century. So that's like, you know, yesterday in this scale of time. They're always quoting things that are thousands of years old. But he just got the first line of the poem out. "This radiance serenely illumines the whole universe." Beautiful, really, right? You know, some radiance illuminates the whole universe. But the teacher stopped him, which we'll come back to in a minute. But this is the first line of a particular poem that there's a story about. And the poem was an enlightenment poem. And enlightenment poems are among the really great treasures, you know, of the Zen literature, which has that built-in push-pull that Zen is a school that claims, you know, to be beyond words and letters, but has this beautiful literate tradition. And there are always some expression, you know, of the openness and depth, the expansiveness and possibility of awakening. And somehow these guys always had like a brush and ink handy, you know, in case they popped off into enlightenment. And there was a lot of poetry being written. In a matter of speaking, the other thing to always to remember when we read these stories is the backdrop is always days and weeks and months of years of steady practice, you know, often tedious, you know, boring, intense, grueling practice, right? So the stories, of course, aren't usually about that because that doesn't make a very good story. But they're about when things open up, you know, through this process. Things spring loose gradually and suddenly. And I'm sure that is still the case, really, right? For all of us. In this case, the writer of the poem was a lay student named Cheng Cho. And he was, a young man, I don't know, you know, mid-20s or something like that. And he had also, at the same time, been studying for examination. Studying to take the examination, starting to be a government official, that in various periods of China, it were more or less a meritocracy. You take an exam, a pretty long exam, apparently very complicated exams, to become a government official of some kind, have a job for life unless you got exiled or something. And I'm sure there was always a mix of the usual human reality in amongst the meritocracy, right? Connections and money and all that power were still at play, I'm sure, you know. But it is kind of cool in a way that this tradition, this civilization, which predates us by so far, you know, and was not a democracy of any means, but in some ways was, had a certain degree of fairness to it, you know, which we espouse to have. But he was also very serious about Zen practice. And when he met the priest who went on to become his teacher, the master asked him a kind of standard Zen question, asked him, "Who are you?" Which is a deep question. You could answer with your name or you could say something else entirely, right? But he just introduced himself. He said, "I'm Chang of the Cho family." And it turns out that the characters for Chang can also be read as awkward. Or awkwardness. And I don't know, I didn't try to look it up, whether that's a common or like a more obscure etymology for those characters. You know, maybe like it's similar in shape to the regular word for awkwardness or sounds the same. I don't know. But there's a connection. But boy, it'd be tough if your parents named you awkward, you know. So there must have been also an ordinary name too. But there was a way of reading his name as awkwardness. And so the teacher said to Cheng Cho, "Ah, you're named awkwardness? There is neither absolute skillfulness nor unconditional awkwardness. How can you keep such a name for the rest of your life?" Gave him a teaching right away. "You are awkwardness? Well, There is neither absolute skillfulness nor unconditional awkwardness. How can you keep a name like that for the rest of your life? And the way Nyogen Senzaki, who I'm reading, you know, about these stories, describes the next moment is, the scholar was fortunate enough to catch a glimpse of the mind essence at the words of the master, and he wrote a poem expressing his attainment. So this is the poem, the whole poem, that Chang Cho wrote in response to his realization with the support of his new teacher, that things are not so messed up in a certain way as he thought, you know. What's the essence, you know, if there's neither absolute skillfulness, no way to be absolutely skillful or talented or right, nor is there unconditional awkwardness, you know, everything's conditioned, everything's fluid, right? Everything's more open than maybe he understood before that moment. So here's the poem he wrote. The radiance serenely illumines the whole universe. The ignorant, the wise, all beings are my family. When no thoughts of discrimination arise, the universe is revealed. If the six sense organs make even the slightest movement, clouds cover the essence. If you try to wipe away delusions, you will suffer endlessly. If you try to reach for the essence, you're going in the wrong direction. Living in accord with things in the world, and you will have no obstructions. Enlightenment and delusions are like colors in a dream or flowers in the air. The radiance serenely illumines the whole universe. The ignorant, the wise, all beings are my family. When no thoughts of discrimination arise, the universe is revealed. The six sense organs make even the slightest movement, clouds cover the essence. If you try to wipe away delusions, you will suffer endlessly. If you try to reach for the essence, you're going in the wrong direction. Living in accord with things in the world, you will have no obstructions. Enlightenment and delusions are like colors in a dream or flowers in the air. So wonderful classic Zen stuff. Cut off the mind road, you know. Be present, be immediate. Stop trying to discriminate and conceptualize and complicate and figure everything out. And then don't try to solve it all and straighten yourself out. That just mucks things up more, right? Let go, be here, open up, right? Sort of single-pointedness of concentration of Zazen. And that's really wonderful. I think one of the things that's a little bit tricky about these koans is they're always encouraging us to kind of go beyond, right? Go beyond. But the thing that they're encouraging us to go beyond is pretty incredible, really, you know, and it is valuable, you know, is a jewel. So it's, I think that's hard for our minds. We're like, well, if you go beyond it, it must not have been that good. No, this is really good. And there's a going beyond it, you know. Wouldn't it be good if we were just more focused, right? More settled, more concentrated, more present, more accepting, you know, not chopping things up into good and bad and right and wrong. And I'm awkward or I'm not awkward, you know. What if we were really living in accord, right? Living in accord, and there's sort of a Taoist flavor in there, isn't there too, you know? And then there's no obstructions, because it just is, right? It just is. So I think that's an important point in all these stories is, yeah, not to lose, not to kind of throw out the jewels, you know, when they encourage us to go beyond the jewels. Sitting matters, you know, slowing down matters. Focus, concentration, it matters. Seeing the way the mind occludes reality and confuses you and our graspiness and how it makes us suffer. Like, basic Buddhism is deep, you know, it's powerful. You can never quite unravel it completely. And you would think that would be a perfectly good thing to be quoting at the Zen temple, you know, this powerful Zen enlightenment poem. And yet the teacher stops him, interrupts. You're just quoting. Stop that. You have misspoken. And the very last part of the koan, which mentions another teacher, actually happens 200 years later. So that's not unusual in these koans. They say later, and it could be a long time later. Because these stories were passed down, right? These are the family tales, and they're mused over and considered. till, you know, apparently until now, right? Here we are. So a later teacher was teaching from this story, brought it up, and asked his students, some other monastery, some other place, tell me, where did the monk misspeak? And that would be what we'd really study and we would really sit with on this koan, you know. Where did you misspeak? Where did the monk misspeak? Speak, misspeak. Did he misspeak by speaking? Is it that it doesn't do any good to just quote somebody else's words, you know, somebody else's enlightenment poem? Shouldn't we be original, or is that an American idea? Or did he misspeak because he knew full well his teacher would know this poem, which obviously he did? Was it a kind of showing off? But actually, memorizing and repeating things is a classical part of, you know, Asian culture and spirituality and Buddhism for sure. So is that really it? And of course, we don't know. You know, we don't know what they were thinking or whether this even actually happened. And what's usually the way these stories are looked at to this day is the teacher is seen as brilliantly skillful, right? The teacher just can see the right action, the skillful action. Maybe a little bit in, which is a little ironic considering what the earlier teacher of Chang Cho said, that there is no absolute skillfulness. But in a way, the teacher, the Zen teacher, is seen as an exemplar of absolute skillfulness. So as always, there's a bit of a joke built in. And so we're usually meant to understand that this was a really smart teaching move to interrupt the monk, to stop him cold, that this is an expression of enlightenment, to sometimes just the right moment, just shake somebody. Like, no, don't say that. Could be, could be. Stop right there, son, you know, stop. But what if the teacher wasn't so skillful? That's possible too, right? These are human beings. Is there skill? Is there non-skill? Maybe it was unhelpful to the monk to interrupt him and not let him express himself fully. And Eiken Roshi in his commentary says he doesn't know of a single other koan that has this, where the teacher interrupts the students. Usually you let the student finish and then you straighten them out in these stories. So is it an example of misuse of authority, deliberately or accidentally? And is that a source of pain for the monk or a source of healing? Do we need to meet the hard stuff? And I don't know if it matters, but this is a part of life, right? Being stopped, being thwarted, being interrupted, being tripped. We have all had this, right? We've all been interrupted. We've all had something to say, and we've all been shut down at one time or another. By parents, by teachers, by lovers, by friends, by bosses, right? Co-workers. Human relationships are complex and varied, right? And every situation is different, and we ourselves have shut people down and stopped them. Helpful, not helpful, just how it goes. But back to, you know, the opening chant before the talk, if we really vow to see and hear everything as Tathagata's words, then that includes this, right? That includes being interrupted, being thwarted, not getting what you want. That needs to be also an avenue, right? A practice, a teaching. So what do we learn? You know, what do we learn when we're thwarted, or in this particular example, interrupted as an example of being thwarted? What have you learned? Has it encouraged you to find your voice and speak up? A moment to be courageous and push yourself forward? Or can that be a sort of false promise, you know? As if we could somehow figure out the right way to be skillful and assertive, and that's back to this idea of there being an absolute skillfulness, right? Such that we will always have great conversations and happy relationships and get it just right and nothing will faze us. That doesn't seem real. So is it helpful, you know, is it helpful to learn to respond skillfully when we get interrupted? Maybe. But maybe it also is confusing to think that we can solve this problem. And of course, Sangha life, we're always experimenting with all this. It happens everywhere, but Sangha life creates a little sort of experimental field, you know. And so in our discussions, in our leadership groups and everything we do, we're always thinking about this, you know, how can we all be heard and how can we honor each other's voices and our diversity and while also honoring the tradition, you know, and people's experience. But we have to be careful there too, right? Are we also ending up giving a false promise, you know? Oh, all input is welcome, except we're going to do it this way. That's part of how it goes too, right? It's complicated. It's complicated. What everyone says in the Sangha or in any setting matters, but does it matter in the way that you think it does or that you're told that it does? Maybe it matters in a different way than that. And you could be disappointed, right? Or you could feel honored, or you could feel empowered, or you could feel tricked. So here we are dancing together, human beings, you know. And there's something deep and tricky in all this around humility and letting go of self. And remember last week when we were talking about the buffalo jumping through the window? If you were here, I pointed out that one of the things that's kind of unique about Zen monastic training is they de-emphasized study and they emphasized the rules of decorum and the guidelines and rules of how the monastery functions. Like every activity is prescribed, you know, and described and written down. And, you know, and so part of how that's seen is a way to develop humility and let go of our pride and our preferences. And that can be so deeply healing, right? As the classic early Zen poem says, the great way is not difficult. Just set aside picking and choosing. And just like the Enlightenment poem of Chang Cho, you know, set aside your thinking and your senses and just be with things as they are. That's freedom. And psychology matters, right? Our well-being also matters, you know. The self matters and we would love to be free of the self. Dogen said, as you know, study the self is to forget the self. But how do we forget the self in a way that's healthy, a way that's useful to us and all beings so that we can do our bodhisattva work for one thing? We can't do our bodhisattva work if we're a total mess, right? If we're collapsed, we can't help anybody. And most of us would not like to be interrupted by the teacher or interrupted by anyone. So, you know, how do we meet that? It's going to happen. Do we form a committee to prevent interruption, you know, try to train the teacher a little better, how to be kind and patient? Or are we getting into a kind of deck chairs and the Titanic problem so easily, right? So readily, getting caught in the relative world where we think if we just arrange it right, if we just have the right structures and the right agreements and the right guidelines, if we just knew each other a little better, if we just understood things, you know, or if they understood things the way I understand them anyway, right? So maybe it's also good to be thwarted, good to be frustrated. Like I mentioned that last week too, I made a little joke that if you haven't been annoyed by Zen, then you haven't practiced long enough. So, you know, hang out longer, you'll get annoyed. Because it is useful, actually, difficult. Sometimes we learn the most when we're kind of at the end of our rope, right? Because that's when we get jarred out of our habitual patterns and things open up. And what's enlightenment but a huge letting go of a habitual pattern, the pattern of how we see reality and life itself is a habit. And awakening is some way that that's loosened and opened up and new possibilities come flooding in. Beautiful and also overwhelming. There's also been contemporary studies of people freaking out from meditation. You know, these strong experiences are not always able to be integrated. They aren't always healthy for people. That doesn't show up in the great Zen literature so much, although there are kind of awakened fools. So where did the monk misspeak anyway? Where do you misspeak? Have you misspoken in talking to yourself? That's probably our most fundamental misspeaking, right? Have each of us created a vision in our minds, in our heads, in our hearts, whether we are aware of it very clearly or not, that if we just had it arranged the right way, we'd be happy. If we could be heard, we'd be happy. And there's nothing wrong with that. See, this is why this stuff's funny to talk about. There's nothing wrong with a good deck chair arrangement, you know? It's more comfortable. We can see each other and have conversations. But the Titanic's going down, you know? So that's not the only thing. You need to learn how to swim, you know? Get the lifeboats out. So, interruption. It's not usually what's emphasized when people comment on the story, but I thought, since our whole world's been interrupted by the virus, it's good to focus on interruption and thwartedness, stoppedness. And of course, we've seen and we're all seeing that there is teachings in all this, right? This forced stop. There's also suffering, right, throughout the world. And there will be suffering as fallout from it, but maybe something new emerges when we all have to stop. When we're interrupted and brought up cold suddenly. And this was so sudden, right? Even if we had perfectly organized leadership like we wish we had, it's still sudden, right? Wasn't even known to the world before December, right? That's not that long ago. The whole world has stopped. It's unbelievable. Big interruption. So it doesn't mean we're ever going to figure this out or be graceful, particularly. Maybe we will always be awkward like Chang Cho's name. But it's productive awkwardness if we give ourselves to it, right? If we practice with it. I've always loved this great Japanese expression, fall down 7 times, get up 8. I actually finally looked up how to say it in Japanese. Nanakorobi yaoki. Nanakorobi yaoki. Fall down 7, get up 8. As long as we keep getting up, we'll be okay. And we'll still be able to help. So I thought we could muse together in small groups tonight for a little while. You know, how is it to be stopped, to be interrupted, to be thwarted? What have you learned from that? Is there a silver lining of growth, you know? There's this idea of post-traumatic growth, but then there's also post-traumatic trauma. Is being thwarted also damaging? Has it also harmed you? You know, and as usual, using respect and common sense around what we choose to share and holding things in confidence if someone decides to share something private from their life, you know, we know. But before that, let's enjoy Cho's poem one more time. And not lose track of that either. All this heady stuff, is it this, is it that? There's also just stopping, right? There's also just focus and there's also just concentration. And that's a healing thing. Maybe we need more than that, is what these koans are trying to tell us. We became incredibly expert at Zen calm and stability, it still wouldn't be enough, but it's also important. So Cho wrote way back when, 6th century. The radiance serenely illumines the whole universe. The ignorant, the wise, all beings are my family. When no thought of discrimination arises, the universe is revealed. If the 6 sense organs make even the slightest movement, clouds cover the essence. You try to wipe away delusion, you suffer endlessly. You try to reach for the essence, you're going in the wrong direction. Living in accord with things in the world, you will have no obstructions. Enlightenment and delusions are like colors in a dream or flowers in the air. So if you're willing to accept the invitation, and is, by the way, if you really are not up for this, you can just listen or pass, or you can, and it's no harm, no foul if you are tired and you log out. We don't, you know, don't feel embarrassed, but they can be interesting conversations for sure. So off we go, groups of 3. Have a good conversation. If you haven't done this Zoom trick before, you have to accept the thing. end, you see a little button that says join breakout or something like that. That's what you want to click. I forget how it's phrased. And if it doesn't work, you and I can chat.